Hey, Social Work Squad. This is Ernesto from Social Work Mentor, and we haven't put something up in a while, but this is our first one back. This is the very first episode of the World's Best Social Work Show, our new live interactive social work show that comes on the second and fourth Friday of every month at 5:30 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. You can find the show on socialworkmentor.com or also streaming live on the Social Work Mentor Facebook or YouTube page. In this very first episode, we have several co-hosts from mostly from TikTok social work fame. And the topics that we had in this very first episode are a discussion about the risks in social work and why we stay on the job even knowing those risks. We have another discussion about systemic changes that are needed and kind of like in the world of prevention. We also talk about this new emerging area of psychedelics in mental health and treatment of depression, PTSD, and other things utilizing psychedelic substances such as mushrooms. So here is the episode. I hope you enjoy it. And we are going to be posting again regularly with our brand new World's Best Social Work Show. So here's the first episode. Hope you enjoy it. And I am about to let everyone know something that I probably should have known maybe when we started, but I didn't. We went live unofficially, but we weren't actually live. So now, this is the perfect start to our first ever social work show. So now we're live. We have no one is in here yet joining us, but we are live. So if you joined us a few minutes ago and you didn't see anything, it's because I forgot to push the button that says live. So now we're live. I had a little practice run, so let me just repeat what I said if I can. So this is a show that we're going to try to do fairly regularly, as you see on the flyers and stuff, the information that we've put out. There's a bunch of different social workers and therapists that will be part of this show who are come from a lot of different perspectives, from macro level social work to therapy to child welfare. And so we're going to hear a lot of different perspectives on all the different topics that we end up talking about on the show. So I am going to do, I guess at this point, introductions, which we had started right before my little snafu there. So my name is Ernesto Bejarano. I live on the West Coast of the United States. Some of you may know me from social media and other places from as Social Work Mentor. And I'm on all the different platforms, but mostly on TikTok these days. And so that's who I am. And we'll go ahead and hear from everybody else and introduce everyone before we get into the topics for today's show. So as we did the first time, the practice round, Heather, why don't you go ahead and introduce yourself to us, please?
Yeah, thanks. So I'm Heather Jewell, and I'm located in the Midwest. And my primary social work experience was as a CPS social worker. I'm currently working on my master's to do clinical work with adolescents that have experienced trauma. And you can find me on TikTok as Hypothetically Heather.
All right, cool. Thank you. Thank you. Okay. So next up, as I see you on my screen, Mara.
Yeah, my name is Mara. I'm also on the West Coast in Northern California. I'm a licensed clinical social worker, and my career has spanned basically the whole lifespan. I mainly work with Latinos here in Northern California, but I've done everything. So macro, meso, micro, as social workers do.
Yes, exactly. All right, perfect. Thank you. I forgot to say that, like, about people's background or about my background necessarily. So Felix, I hope when you introduce yourself here, you can give us also a little bit of kind of the work you've done as well as who you are and where you're from.
Absolutely. So I am Felix, and you may know me on TikTok as Mr. Social Worker 12, or as I like to say, your neighborhood social worker. I am currently in the middle of this country, but as you can tell from the accent, I am born and raised Southern. I am also a former CPS worker, and I currently work in Medicaid, helping people get connected to behavioral health services. But I have also done school social work, foster care. I've taught school for a little while, and I think that's everything. And so, yeah, I've done a little bit of everything, and nice. I do focus on women and children, and making sure that they get service. Oh, I've done homeless services for families. That's it. Okay. So yeah, that's me, and that's what I do.
That's all you've done. That's it.
I know, right? I've been all over the place.
All right, cool. Sabrina, how are you?
Great. Hi, everyone. I'm Sabrina Gillen-Kaiser. You can usually find me on either TikTok, or I just kind of revamped my Instagram. So Sabrina in social work, pretty easy. I am a macro social worker. I did start out in direct practice working in the disability community and then working in behavioral health within the disability community, specifically the deaf community. Went to go get my MSW and realized I did not like doing therapy at all and just would rather gouge my eyeball out. And so, you know, I panicked, figured out, I don't know what I want to do. Did some more direct service in the poverty space, and then went into the macro field where I was a policy director. So that's a lot of what I talk about is social workers in public policy. And I also do a lot of administration. So overseeing large swaths of the country, providing social services for, you know, specific organization. And I also, just kind of really stay in the macro space. So that's the perspective I hope to bring to this conversation. And I'm happy to be here. Also on the West Coast currently, but was on the East Coast for a vast majority of my life. So
nice. Well, first of all, I want to say you have an excellent microphone. So I don't know how my sounds to everyone else, but I like the sound of that one. I might need to.
You know, when you buy them, you might as well use them, is how I feel about them. Yeah.
All right. So if you're watching this or hearing this, hopefully you're starting to see the very different perspectives. And we have one more person here with us today who also has a super interesting perspective that they bring. So Brittany, why don't you go ahead and tell us about yourself?
Hi, my name is Brittany. I go by B Williams LCSW on Instagram and TikTok, pretty active on there. I'm originally from LA County, but I am currently located in San Diego. And I am many things. I'm a psychotherapist. I own a group practice, and I also am an adjunct professor. So I have experience run with a macro piece of it, because I had to learn how to run a business and how to market and how to partner in the community. And that's been so awesome, but new to me. The micro work is I'm big on the clinical piece. So I'm constantly learning, constantly reading, constantly growing as a clinician. It's a really big passion of mine to stay up with the research and to service my clients the best way possible. And I also teach. So me and my business partner, Carlos, are both adjunct professors. We teach social work courses at the local community college here in San Diego. Mm-hmm. And I think I covered everything. Did I miss anything?
I think you got, we'll find out as the show goes on. Okay. But as far as I know, I think you got the important stuff, and that's what matters. Okay.
So
as you can see, and as you've heard, we have a super diverse group here. And I'm looking forward as we move along in the show to hearing just how those different histories and experiences kind of impact how we think about things in the world, whether they're related to social work or even pop culture or whatever. Mm-hmm. So let's go ahead and get started with some of our topics for today's show, episode one. So the first one is kind of to start it with, it's kind of bringing us to the reality of some of the work that we do or have done or maybe will do. And that's the, you know, the possible, you know, risks or dangers of this field. And, you know, we hear a lot about social workers, and oftentimes it's people's perceptions that may not be the greatest about some of the work that we do. But those of us who are in the field know, you know, first of all, the positive impact that we have that doesn't always see the light of day so much, but also the risks. And so just this week, it was the 2-year anniversary of Silvia Bracamontes, who was a social worker in the Bay Area of California. And right when the pandemic hit and in California, when kind of the shutdown happened, she was running a group home. And because they were going to be having to stay in the group home, she went out to get food for the youth that were staying there. And when she came back to drop off the food, one of the youth who, you know, was going through some stuff, obviously, stabbed her, and she ended up not surviving the stabbing. And so in the course of the work, that's one example of the risks that happened. And we commemorate this day for Sylvia and all the work that she did and her life that she gave for the work to help, you know, that was taken by one of the people that she was actually helping. And a lot of us are confronted with that or have been confronted with those kinds of realities in the work. So the question that we're going to start with, or kind of the topic, is given that scenario and the respect that we're giving to Sylvia, the question for this discussion is, knowing the potential risk that we have on this job, why do we do what we do? Why do social workers choose to get into and stay in this profession, knowing that there are these risks, and we don't have a bulletproof vest, we don't have a taser, we walk into these situations with a clipboard and a pen? And so, you know, anyone, I guess you can throw out your thoughts about why do people choose to do this with those risks?
I'm going to add, you don't just walk in with a clipboard and a pen. You also walk in with some tennis shoes, and you walk in with your eyes open. And I think, I mean, just for me, when I was in the field, like, I think safety, although it was always in the forefront, mm-hmm. I think it was also like just one of those things that it's almost like it goes on the back burner once you're with clients, right? Because our profession is about meeting our clients where they're at, whether, you know, it's be in their home or in the community or whatever. And I mean, you know, Sylvia was in a neighboring county of ours, you know, or where I live. And, you know, I think for it also impacts the way that small communities, because up here in Northern California, we're, you know, we have some smaller counties. And I think that kind of circumstance can also lead into that, like, panic that the community is like, oh my gosh, you have a group home where? In what neighborhood? And it's like, that's rare. Like, our safety, although it is in jeopardy at times, those situations are really minimal. And we do a lot more other stuff. So, you know, I had a trainer that said, when in doubt, run with confidence. And I'd be like, let's go. Like, you know, just the client will always be there waiting for you. If you don't feel safe, just run, yeah. You know, and it's okay.
Yeah, that's, I think you bring up for me an excellent point of just how, you know, it's, we have to be careful that we don't get complacent sometimes, because you're just doing the work and you are trying to meet the client where they are, and you can get complacent and get comfortable with the situation. And maybe that ends up being putting you at risk. Anyone else have thoughts on this? Why do we stay in this profession?
So I would just add, you know, as a CPS worker, one of the things that we're taught is that worker safety is, it's up to you. You are the person ultimately that is responsible for your own safety. And if you feel unsafe, then you leave immediately. Obviously, they taught us other safety measures to take to be as safe as possible. But I think it really boils down to all social workers that we are called to or inherently want to help other people. And, you know, we're willing to take the risk that we may be meeting with someone that is has a potential for violence. But it's because we inherently see the good in people and that we want to support them, even though they're experiencing challenges or struggles that lead them to those violent outbursts, the potential of the violent outburst. So I really think that's what it boils down to for all social workers.
That's a great point. Anyone else?
Go ahead. For me, I just don't, I've been in many situations where I have had a client, you know, put a knife in front of me, like intimidating type of factors. And there are safety precautions, right? Like make sure you know where the door is, make sure you know where you're seated, all those things. I think the best advice I ever got was trust your gut. Because even though those things may not be as obvious, like your body knows. But with that said, there are some things that come up that we don't see and we don't get. And I think for me, I stay in the work because I know that those behaviors are not personal. I understand the brain. I understand developmental trauma. I understand like what biologically where how they have had to process things and how a trigger could be anything, right? So when I have when I would go into, you know, group homes or work TBS, I would really emphasize like giving the client control, right? Mm-hmm. Like we get to talk about what you want to talk about. We get to you, this is your space. Like I'm just here to like connect and to support. And I believe that that was, you know, I believe that that's the intention of all social workers. And but I do want to say, like, there are some things that we miss, you know, and that work is still honorable, I feel like. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I'll go ahead, Sabrina. I look like you're about to say something.
Yeah, I was just going to bring the dorky research side in real quick. And
we want that for sure.
You know, the one thing that always, you know, because going into people's homes, going into the field, I worked in a residential facility for quite a few years. And so obviously there's a lot of kiddos who have a lot of things going on. And I was just, you know, as I was thinking about these questions, I was like, well, how dangerous is it to be a social worker? Like, is this, you know, how valid is that concern? And, fun fact, we are the 20th most dangerous occupation in the country, according to the Bureau of Labor and Statistics.
Wow.
So granted, I'm doing some other work with the Bureau of Labor and Statistics to try to change the definition for social work because they have it as pretty narrow direct practice, some meso. But, you know, I think that that is really important to understand that when it comes to that definition for social work, we are in one of the most dangerous professions. So one to every 100,000 social workers will be injured on the job. And I think probably all of us have had some type of either close call, like Brittany was talking about, where, you know, there's a knife and you're like, well, this is going to go one of two ways.
Yeah.
Or there are situations where, you know, for, you know, when I've been injured, it was because the client was at a higher risk of injury than I was in this situation. And so, you know, you take the calculated risk. But it really, I mean, that is, I was surprised by how high it was on that list. And it's just something that's good to keep in mind as we are interacting with people. But even I know from like an administrative role, I worked for a really big organization. And so I had like a go bag and I knew how to barricade my door because I was like, you never know when someone's real mad at the organization and can just burst up in here and, you know, who has a gun or whatever the case may be. And so even from an administrative level, being really cognizant of the potential danger when you're working with people who have been severely traumatized and what that looks like for you and to have your plan, have your safety considered.
And so I have just a thought. Mm-hmm. I also think about like the systemic challenges of how level of care, right? Like, did we miss, you know, are they in the right level of care? And then how, you know, we may not be whoever the social worker is, whatever the job is, the level of training, equipped or supported enough to support that. That person. And so I think we do have to take into consideration that piece too.
Yeah, that, I'm glad you said that. That's an excellent point because what I was thinking as Sabrina was talking, first of all, thanks for bringing those statistics too. That's why we need policy macro level person here for the for that perspective as well. But, you know, to your point, Brittany, I think that you're right in terms of systemic work that needs to be done to better prepare and equip workers to be able to, you know, make sure we catch everything that we can and are prepared when we're out in the field. I think also an important part of it is those of us, well, first of all, I'm saying this as a male, you know, pretty decent sized dude who has a very different perspective out in the field than I would imagine, you know, some of my female counterparts do. But acknowledging that, I think that it's incumbent upon those of us who have been around a while too, to kind of be those models and be not so like insular in our work and in silos, but actually reaching out to some of our newer colleagues, which they're, at least where I work and what I've seen, there's pretty decent amount of turnover, particularly more recently. So it's a lot of it, I think, is for us, because you can get training, you can get, you know, policies, you can get your academic background, but it, I think a big part of it is on the ground, out in the field with some of those seasoned workers shadowing and getting those experiences. And if you are a newer worker, looking for those opportunities too, because I think that's a big part of how we kind of get those subtle nuances of the work, is just by working with our colleagues. So yeah, so I don't feel, I was looking over here, I didn't see if you had something going on, Felix.
Yeah, I want to say
something. Go ahead.
No, not to just be redundant on what everyone else has said, I just think about in my career, and Ernesto, you actually kind of went in the direction, you know, as a, you know, 6 feet tall, 300 pound man, it wasn't too many times that I was afraid to go into a home doing a home visit. But I have had those moments. But even when, before leaving Child Protective Services, I was a senior lead on my team. And so I actually did have a colleague who was fresh out of college. This was her first job. And one of the things that I taught her was being able to set boundaries day one. And she would ask, well, what do you mean? What does that look like? And for me, it was from the tone in my voice, from what going into what we're talking about, and staying on task as much as possible without being rude, right? And then also just knowing your environment. So if I'm here in Colorado, so there's a neighborhood called Castle Pines. If I was going to Castle Pines, I don't have no worries, because everybody over there make 10 times what I'll ever make in my life, right? But if I was going into Aurora, which is where I work, portions in places in Aurora, the day before I probably went by that house, right? Mm-hmm. Before I actually went. Or if I went, I chose a time that may be the busiest, where there's a lot of people about, right? Mm-hmm. And so I think it's just important, as we apply everything that has already been said, it's also being able to just set those boundaries and just have the confidence that that at the end of the day, I'm going to go home and you're going to be safe as well.
Yeah. I appreciate, Felix, that you brought up that point. Like, as bigger males, you know, out in the field, like, even though that's the case, I too have been threatened and been in the middle of, you know, these kind of gang altercations. And really, you know, mm-hmm. you never know what happens in any given situation, no matter who you are. And we did have a comment from someone who's watching live on LinkedIn, Latiki Panky Carter. Thank you for that comment, which kind of confirms some of what we're talking about, the lack of support from agencies. So mm-hmm. I know, you know, a few of us have talked about that systemic support that we need to build into yeah. the work that we do. So any other comments about this topic? I think the original question being, knowing the risk, why do we do what we do? And I think Mara originally, and a few people touched, for me at least, on the fact that we know those risks are there. They may be few and far between, but they could be still very significant. But in between those risks, there is so much when you find housing for someone, or when you move someone along emotionally, or whatever it may be, you know, those moments, you hear it all the time, but it really is what keeps us, at least for me, keeps me in the work. So any other comments before we move on?
I would just say, for 16 years, I've tried to leave this profession, but yet I'm still here 16 years later. That's
that's a great way to finish that topic. All right. So we're going to move on now to the next topic we have here, the segment that for now I'm calling Macro Minute-ish. So it's looking a little bit kind of at the big, we're talking already about systemic stuff, but looking at some of the systemic questions or policy questions that lead to the work that some people do as direct service. I'm going to show a short little clip here, and then we'll go ahead and talk about the question. So just ahead of time, the question will be what systemic changes are or would be most effective in addressing the challenges identified in the clip. So let me see if I can get this to work. And we'll come back.
All right, Baldacci.
Yes, sir.
Baldacci.
Can you all hear that?
Yeah.
Okay, here we go.
Where'd you grow up? Where are you from originally?
I'm from Los Angeles, Florence District, South Los Angeles, basically. That's what it basically is.
Mm-hmm. And tell me, about your family growing up, you had mom and dad?
Yeah, my mom and dad, you know, they're born here as well. I was born actually at the hospital, Sentinella Hospital in the city of Inglewood. And from that hospital, I was took to a street called Converse. That's why I got this Converse All-Star tattoo, because I'm an All-Star actually from the block, you know what I mean? Growing up, you know, my mom was basically the main person in the home because my father, he was in prison for a long time gone. And you know, so it was a little bit, you know, harder for me, being the fact that, you know, my father was gone. I'm not going to blame that totally on, you know, him being gone, me being what I am today or everything that I live is because of that. But it's definitely hard without a father figure in the home.
Yeah. What was dad in prison for?
My dad was in prison for a bunch of robberies, you know, growing up. That's, I guess.
Was he in a gang?
Yeah. My dad was also from Florence, as well. My brothers, my sisters, basically all of us except for my mom. Mom was the one that stuck to working two jobs to try to, you know, feed us and keep us, you know, in a straight line. But at the end of the day, it's like, you know, you go for what you want to do. It's mm-hmm. not, you know.
How far did you go in school?
I actually got a GED, but I did get my GED through the prison system. On the streets, I went to maybe like seventh grade, maybe eighth grade, and then it was basically I went to juvenile hall from there. Like I was a kid, gone. Like, you know what I mean? I was living the street life.
So the gang stuff started for you early?
13 years old, you know, I was being intrigued by the lifestyle and kind of amazed by it, and just basically went towards it instead of actually trying to live a different life. Like that was what was in my future, I guess.
Did the idea of being anything else in life come into your head?
Like, I honestly, at a young age, I didn't really think about no career. I really didn't think about what I wanted in the future. I really didn't think about my future, to be honest with you. It was just day for day that I was living. That's what happened, basically. I ended up,
You're down in Florence, which...
Yeah, Florence.
Florencia is one of the most notorious gangs.
Yeah, that's where I'm from. You know, basically, like I said, at a young age, that's what caught my attention, and that's what I ended up, you know, becoming a part of.
And it didn't take long for you to go to prison?
No, I mean, it took as long as me to turn the legal age to go. You know what I mean? Like, mm-hmm. At the end of the day, like, I started going to juvenile halls real young, at the age of 13, 14, going in and out. You know, my first time going, I actually
got juvenile halls.
Okay, let me see if I can get that. So that's the clip there. If you want to see the rest of the clip, if you're watching this later, it's Soft White Underbelly is the name of the YouTube channel. You can all hear me now? Am I back? Okay. So we see, you know, something that many of us have seen, the maybe adults who have lived a certain kind of life. It may be a gang life. It may be other, you know, lifestyles that they choose to go into, not necessarily gangs, but sometimes we see a similar pattern of what led up to that. And we heard this individual talk about the opportunities or lack thereof in his community and his family situation. So it's a reality, and it's been a reality for a long time. But I'm wondering what people's thoughts are in terms of, like I said, the question being what policy level changes do we need to see or do we need to advocate for to try to improve situations like this? And I might be looking at Sabrina to start us off since given the question, but it's okay if somebody else wants to. But Sabrina, if you got something, you can go ahead and start.
Sure. So it's actually really interesting. And now, of course, the name is popping out of my head. But the first piece of legislation I ever advocated on behalf of on Capitol Hill was specifically about resourcing under-resourced communities to prevent gang violence, but also just gang interaction, and giving kids other opportunities and investing in them in ways that we all know are like protective factors, right? So we all know that if you give kids, food and like safe places to be after school, investing in alternative options for them. Cause it, you know, the way Baldacci talks is that was the option. There was no alternative option. That was what he was going to do because that was the thing that was available to him. And that was the thing that he was going to be safe doing, quite frankly. So there is legislation and, you know, like I was saying, this is the first thing I, actually advocated on behalf of. And one of the things that I heard, and if you have seen any of my TikToks, this might be the one, which is that one of the reasons it was really hard to get it passed. So it was a congressman from Virginia who has been trying to pass this for like 2 decades, probably. Basically, what he said is that it's really hard to get conservatives to invest in prevention, but they will invest in the intervention after the thing already happened. So we don't pay for things that we don't know we can prevent. Obviously, research does show us that there are ways to prevent kids from going into gangs and going into juvenile detention centers, which we know the minute that they step into a juvenile detention center or jail or prison, they are now, I forget the stat, I think it's like 20 times more likely to go in again. And so for the folks who work in prevention, right? For those of us who really care about this, we know that if you invest in the front end, you don't have to spend as much in the back end. It's the same thing with homelessness that we talk about all the time. Invest in that front end. And unfortunately, that is typically not the thing that gets invested in because you can't prove that it was effective because you can't prove that those kids would have gone to jail if you didn't put this in place. So instead, we pay at the back end, and it typically is really expensive on the back end. You know, paying for prison is super expensive. Paying for folks to stay unhoused is super expensive. And so it kind of goes through this, these just like beliefs of how effective is intervention at very early stages, and what does the research show, and are we actually willing to listen to the research?
Yeah, I'm glad you said that because, you know, just from a local level, some policy or advocating work that I've seen, it's exactly what you're saying, is that, you know, even for local governments are much more likely, at least in my experience, to invest in intervention or even suppression efforts when, you know, prevention, at least, you know, anecdotally sometimes even seems to be working, but it's very hard to make that direct connection. And so the money waits until something actually happens and then we do something. I wonder, Heather, do you, like from a child welfare perspective, do you see things in the system that can be done or that we need to examine or think about in terms of child welfare policy and how that might impact outcomes for kids in the system or families in the system? What policy changes do we need there?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I think, you know, Sabrina pointed out that for the prevention, and under the Trump administration, there was a new, you know, Family First Preservation Act, basically to try to add more prevention in place, because unfortunately the child welfare system is a very reactive system. And so what that family probation looks like is still not truly prevention. because we are still coming in contact with families after there's been an allegation of abuse or neglect. So we're not even a prevention, like that's, it's preservation. That's not prevention still. And so prior to this, I actually looked up some statistics. And as of 2007, there was 1.7 million children that experienced parental incarceration. And, you know, the research shows that those children that have parents incarcerated are more likely to experience incarceration when they become adults and or exhibit the same like antisocial type personality traits that lead them into criminal activity. So I, you know, as far as the child welfare goes, prevention services really need to be in place for those parents that are experiencing a spouse or a partner that's incarcerated, because why we see them is lack of supervision, because the parent, the single parent that's at home is trying to work sometimes two or three jobs just to keep the lights on and food on the table, and then that leaves their children either not in after school programs because they can't afford them because there's not adequate resources, especially in rural communities, or the, you know, the kids are out and doing things that they shouldn't be doing because they don't have anyone at home to, to monitor them. You know, if we had prevention services in place to be able to, you know, provide more outlets for those kids, I think it would really make a difference and an impact for us to not come in contact with families because of lack of supervision.
Yeah. Yeah. Anyone else have thoughts on this?
I mean, I think that a big policy change, if we're really trying to improve or decrease mental health, is looking at maternity leave. I mean, if we're really going to be serious about looking at trauma from trauma is an epidemic, right? If we're really going to get serious about addressing that, then we need to address maternity leave and how, you know, individuals giving birth get what, 6 weeks. We know clinically the impact of attachment, and we also know the impact of stress that a pregnant person experiences and how those stress hormones can get transferred, right? Like we look at the book, It Didn't Start With You, right? So I think that if we're going to get serious about it and we're really going to tackle it from the root of it, I think that's a policy that should certainly be looked at and addressed. And I wonder, maybe from, I'm not a researcher, right? But I wonder from other countries that do invest in that piece, what does their prison rate look like? What do their statistics look like in their country versus ours?
Yeah, that would be interesting. And I know, you know, a lot of us have international followers. And so it would be interesting to, maybe some of them will see this and talk a little bit, or maybe even have, if you identify one, maybe we can have them on the show and talk. I'm always interested in, now with social networks and TikTok and everything, just seeing the parallels and the differences of social work in different places, whether it's in another part of my state or in halfway across the world. It's super interesting. So that would be a topic to really look at. But that's an excellent policy thing that I totally had not really considered. Anyone else on this?
Go ahead, Felix.
I would say something that I would like to see is, and Sabrina kind of talked about it, is a better investment in, and even Heather mentioned, true prevention. There are organizations that are within our communities that, you know, they rely on funds from donations or, you know, if there are organizations like my fraternity that I'm a member of, you know, our membership dues and things like that to help. So we have a program that's called Sigma Beta, which reaches children ages 7 to 18. But that program is primarily funded through the organization. There's no big grant money per se coming in to help really reach those communities where it's needed. I think about like where I came from, although I came from a small town, there was a whole lot that could have prevented me from being who I am today. But of course, I'm a little older, but our church is actually invested in us and invested in the community. So every summer we had the summer reading program, and there was no, oh, do you want to go? Oh, you're going to the summer reading program, right? And so that wasn't much of a choice. But I even think about, you know, my uncle is a retired police officer, and at the time he was a young officer. And I decided I was going to go with a group of friends and break into the elementary school. Well, he saved me from basically getting a sentence because I was guilty. There was some other punishment behind that. But if that, even for me, that prevention. So just having people in place that can reach people to say, okay, this is what we're going to invest in you now. We see what the problem is. And I think, you know, like Sabrina said, a lot of times, this country would just rather, you know, build another prison and raise taxes so we can pay for it.
Make money off it. Yeah. Ara, you were going to say something. Thank you, Felix.
Yeah. I think I have I feel like I have a really unique perspective because I worked in county mental health. So like Sabrina's talking about federal, and I'm thinking, well, here in California, for behavioral health, at least we have what's called Prop 63, which is the millionaire tax, which is like millionaires get that 1% tax, and we get this pool of money, and we have, you know, pots of money for something called PEI, which is prevention and early intervention, but it's for mental health, right? And that's what, for me as a social worker, angers me, is that there's so many silos, right? Like there's child welfare, there's macro, there's behavioral health, there's substance abuse. And the thing is, it's like we all deal with the same communities. Like, it doesn't matter if I'm dealing with behavioral health, you know, Felix is probably dealing with the family for housing, you know, and there's no communication and funds don't cross. And that's what is so annoying for me. And that's why I left county work, because it was like, I would talk to my public health counterparts and they'd be like, oh my gosh, we have all this money and it's so good. And we're going to be doing this. And we're going to get, you know, WIC involved, and we're going to get this involved. And it's like, when mental health has money, mental health is like, if you don't fit into it, you're not getting it, literally. Mm-hmm. And I think the other thing with this is our communities need to be more involved. And when I say that, I mean, they have to go to meetings. They have to be pounding on the door and be like, we need more church involvement. We need more of this. Because if government doesn't hear you, it's not going to happen. And sorry, you got me on my soapbox now. Because this is like,
that's what we want. Preach.
Because like for me, my position in the county was the Latino outreach coordinator. And it's like, okay, but where's the meetings in Spanish? You're telling me to go get clients or people to have their opinion, but you're not providing interpreters, or Tagalog, because we have a huge Filipino community. And it's like, government, unfortunately, is so narrow-minded when it comes to these things, that it's like, when anything of innovation comes in, it's like, no, I'm sorry, we've been using this book for 90 years, and that's the same book we're going to continue to use. And it's like, so then don't tell me that we're not making it, like, you're the problem. Like, we go to school and we bring new ideas, but you tell us now it doesn't work. Well, yeah, it doesn't work because the community has changed and that book is not for the community. Mm-hmm. So like that's part of the big issue, I think, as well, is that communities are so isolated from these processes, right? Like you have your mental health advisory board, you have your board of supervisors. No one knows about government. No one knows how to get into these roles. And so it's like, we as social workers are the only voice that some of our communities have. But to be honest, I left county mental health because I was burnt out and my voice wasn't being heard. So I was like, I'll go to private practice because you know what? I can see the people, I can help them, I can give them resources, and I won't get in trouble because I give them resources. You know, I'll be like, you didn't hear it from me, but you can call such and such number. You know, it's like, what are you going to do? Fire me? Well, I don't work for you anymore.
That's so crazy that, I mean, I don't know how many of you can connect with that comment, but I totally connect with that comment where like, you're trying to give resources and help people on the down low because you don't want your organization to like say that you crossed some bureaucratic red tape line when, you know, the what you're trying to get at is an outcome. And Mara, your comment actually segues to what I wanted to say perfectly, because you know, when you say the community, our communities have to be involved and advocate for the services that they need, but it's not always accessible for them. It's not easy to understand these county or local processes. And so part of what I think social workers have, number one, the absolute ability and expertise in, but also the need to do, is get involved even beyond kind of advocating individually with clients, but actually putting themselves into positions where those decisions are made. And, you know, oh, Felix got kicked out, but let me get him back in here. What I was going to say, there we go, we missed you. So I'm fortunate enough to, the past 4 years, I've been serving on just a local school board here as an elected trustee on that board, but I'm able to bring that social work lens to the work. And the district that I am serving for on is a, you know, it's a very diverse community, but it's historically just very socioeconomically more challenged. And so academically, those outcomes are always in question because, you know, for some of the things that people have talked about, people are living in garages or don't have access to internet or all the different challenges that we see. And so a lot of our resources that we've made decisions on in the past few years have been, you know, we want to divert money to or put money towards academics, but we know that our students can't focus on ABC 123 when they haven't eaten in a day and a half, or when their mom and dad are fighting. So we're spending money putting in social emotional learning and developing a whole SEL department and getting resources for that. And so with the community at large, sometimes they will look at our district and say, oh, look at your test scores, you guys aren't performing, you guys, you know, you're not doing what you need to do. But they don't understand the challenges that the families that we are dealing with need to address before they can even get to the school stuff. So it's those, and so it's our job, you know, part of what I've done and some of my colleagues is make these meetings more accessible. It is because our community has come and demanded resources for their children and, you know, restorative justice and, you know, all the different programs that there are. It's because they came and pounded on our door and, I mean, they didn't need to scream and yell too much because we were on board with them. But, you know, it's that of involvement by social workers that I think and that I've seen from local levels like mine all the way up to the national level that can really at least begin to help people understand that the work isn't always about, like, you know, there's work to be done before we can get to like academics or whatever to address socioeconomic challenges. So I kind of got on a little bit of a soapbox there myself, but anyway, Felix, we're seeing him pop in and out. I hope you're able.
Yeah,
to
I'm sorry. Like somebody knocked on the door. So
oh, I thought you were having.
It's all good. No.
Friday night, Ernesto.
Felix is stepping out for a little beverage.
No, I did miss the bulk of the conversation because I got kicked out. But just thinking about policy, absolutely. Just as a former CPS worker, it would frustrate me so bad that the policies that were meant to help families, and Heather probably can definitely chime in, would almost 90% of the time hurt the families. Because if you're going to penalize a mom who has to go to work, and maybe she did leave the 10-year-old at home so she could go to work, and you're telling her, no, she needs to watch the kid, but who's going to feed them if she doesn't go to work?
And then you'll be knocking on her door for that.
Right. Right. So those things used to frustrate me.
That's one of the main reasons that I got into policy, was because I would go and I figured out how many people are making decisions who have never had to step foot in any one of the offices that they dictate. They have, you know, and particularly when we're talking about like Congress, but even when you go down to like state and even local legislature, you have to have money or know people with money in order to run. There are minimums for fundraising. And so like just that right off the bat, right? Or the way you get into these jobs is because you interned. How do you intern when it, you know, oh, it's an unpaid internship and in, you know, the most expensive cities in the country. And so when you just have people of privilege making decisions about how everyone else's lives work, that's why I knew we needed social workers. Like for me on Capitol Hill, I actually, you know, I do California state stuff too. But that was the imperative for me to do it, was because they would make these choices. I was at the, can I tell a quick story? Do you guys mind?
Yes, like, please.
Disconnected story. So my favorite disconnected story was, I was on Capitol Hill. It was during like the waste, fraud, and abuse years of, you know, it was probably like 2014. And I was in an office and they were like, waste, fraud, and abuse. Everyone's abusing SNAP. So for those who don't know, food stamps. But, you know, SNAP assistance. So they said, I have these like two, God bless them, 21-year-olds who were like, you know, were probably unpaid interns at first. And they were like, we think that people should have to recertify every other month for SNAP benefits. And see all of your faces just did the thing that my face did, which was like, are you out of your mind? I'm like, oh, okay. So have you ever done that before? And they were like, no. And I was like, you probably should just try it. And they're like, we wouldn't qualify. And I was like, I know, but you should just try to do it. So what I had to do was say, okay, have you ever like lost your driver's license, or have you ever had to get like a new social security card? And the thing that everyone always does, like everyone hates the DMV equally, right? So you can always say like, have you ever had to go to the DMV? And everyone always goes, oh, it's terrible. And I'm like, okay, so now you're going to go to the DMV and you have your toddler and your baby who couldn't go to daycare that day because you had to get in line an hour before the DMV opened, which also means you can't go to work that day for your minimum wage job, which doesn't have any paid time off, so that you can, you know, in this case, get your new SNAP card or recertify. Mm-hmm. But what happens every time you go to the DMV? You never brought the right papers. You always have to go back two or three more times to the DMV. And they were like, it can't be that bad. And I was like, friends, let's have experience. Yeah. And so it just was, for me, it was just that moment of like, oh man, this is why we need people who understand the systems to actually be on these floors in these offices, because you have the people making decisions who've literally never even probably talked to anybody who was on SNAP, for goodness sake, let alone had to actually experience the systems that they put in place and that they create. So I think that that's like one of the biggest things about social workers being in policy that I always am like trying to toot the horn for.
Yeah, that's an awesome story, Sabrina. Thank you for that. And you didn't even touch, I mean, you're on the bus.
I'm going to use that story.
Yeah, too. You didn't even touch on all the other challenges, being on the bus and missing your...
Right, exactly. I was like, let's do the first three that you could relate to.
yeah, so that I think that's a perfect way for us to, at least for now, to end this conversation, which is a great conversation about, you know, just the impact that social workers can have. And we really need to push ourselves and our colleagues to get into some of these positions and at least consider, you know, doing some of that work. And so with that, we'll move on to our last segment for today, which I'll tentatively call the therapy session. So some of you that are doing some therapeutic work, direct services, might have something to say about this. So I'll see if I can show this video, this last little clip. And the question will be, what are the potential benefits and challenges of utilizing psychedelics in treatment? So obviously that's a hint to where this video is going. So let me see if I can get it going here.
There's a resurgence in studies looking at the potential use of psychedelic drugs to treat a variety of psychological issues. After decades of legal restrictions, drugs like magic mushrooms and LSD are being studied as treatments for depression and anxiety. All new at 5:30, WCNC Charlotte's Lexi Wilson has more on the groundbreaking research underway right now.
Psychedelic drugs have been reported to trigger life-altering experiences, but they are labeled a Schedule I drug, labeled dangerous and illegal. But one UNC professor I spoke to said there's growing research that this surprising treatment will help people with mental illness out of the dark.
One beer makes you larger.
The 1960s revolution brought on experimentation with sex, lifestyles, and psychedelic drugs. Illegal most of these drugs may be, but recent research suggests some of them could have legitimate uses.
These potential medications, which in the studies so far appear to have this, you know, really miraculous effect and really debilitating mental illness.
UNC Chapel Hill professor Dr. Brian Roth is researching how these mind-altering drugs can treat mental illness. For Roth, the research is personal.
My mother had schizophrenia, and I think she had her first break when I was 5 or 6. I was highly motivated to find out, you know, what the heck is going on in the brain.
Mental health treatment hasn't changed in generations, limited primarily to psychotherapy and medication. And while tripping on LSD or magic mushrooms may not sound like a conventional therapy session, Roth says brain scans have shown psychedelics may increase connectivity among different regions of the brain.
Basically, a single dose of these drugs has this sort of very robust and long-lasting effect in people with very difficult to treat depression.
Still, there's a lot more work that has to be done before these treatments would be rolled out to the public.
Assuming this ever gets approved by the FDA, it's not going to be that you would go to your doctor and take some mushrooms home. It would be part of some integrated treatment.
All right. So you can hear me? Am I back? Okay. So that's something that's kind of, I'm not a person who works too much on the therapeutic end of things at this time, but I still, it's this kind of, potential or whatever is still on my radar. I'm seeing it, I'm hearing about it. And so I'm not sure, we could start anywhere, but I don't know if Mara or Brittany, since you're maybe a little more in the therapeutic world, if you might want to start, or we could start anywhere. You have anyone have thoughts?
Go ahead,
on
Brittany.
I mean, I will just say, I'm super fascinated with this. I don't know everything, or I don't know as much as I should yet, but I'm EMDR trained. And so one of the things that I do find with some of my clients who have tried ayahuasca or any type of psychedelics is that they see the images that we work to pull up in EMDR. So in EMDR, we look at a trauma memory and we ask our clients, like, what image represents the worst part of that incident? And they might say, seeing myself scared. Right. And so with the people that I've worked with that have tried psychedelics like that, that's an image that pops up for them, and they get in tune with feeling it and seeing themselves from different perspectives. We work to do that in EMDR with resourcing. And so there are a lot of like overlaps that I've seen. I've even had clients after EMDR say that they see that, or in EMDR sessions saying they see color and they feel like a vibration right through their body. So I don't know if those two overlaps, but I'm super fascinated with it. So yeah, Mara, I'll pass it to you because I'm curious what you think.
My brain literally goes to like the systemic part, I think, because like for me, the community I work with is undocumented, right? So like, it's all about access, right? Like, who is going to be able to get this treatment? Like, it's already hard enough to get Prozac. And you're telling me that now if you have had Prozac for 20 years and it's not working, you can get on LSD, but how do you afford it, right? Or if you're caught with LSD, you can be deported, right? So like, for me, when these research studies happen, it really grinds me because I'm like, you're not looking at the population that most definitely could benefit from it. Because the reality is, it's still a privilege to even get medication, right? There are many people that can't even come to therapy, right? Like, that's the biggest reality, is that for those of us that are in private practice, it's a constant battle to think, am I going to be on an insurance panel or am I going to be private pay? Because insurance panels are basically the devil in disguise. Mm-hmm. They'll say, yes, we cover 90% of your therapy appointment after you've reached your $5,000 deductible. And it's like, people are like, how am I supposed to spend $5,000 on therapy? That's ridiculous, right? So like, when I hear about these studies, although I think it's amazing, and it's not like we haven't tried it before, like what Brittany's saying, like we have clients who be getting on peyote and they'd be like, oh, like I'm good. Like, I don't need to come to therapy anymore. I'm like, well, let's figure this out before you just try it, right? Like, mm-hmm. Or like marijuana. I mean, I almost slipped there. Adderall. Adderall is one of the hardest pills for some of our clients to get on, even though they've been diagnosed with ADHD since they were maybe in middle school. Now that they're adults, oh no, that's a Schedule I drug. And as a primary care doctor, I can't give you Adderall. You have to go to a psychiatrist. So like, it's great in theory, but I think practicing it as a private practice therapist, I always say, if it doesn't hurt you, do it. Don't let me know if it hurts you, because then I got to do something about it. But if you're not putting anyone in danger and you're okay, and you come to therapy and you're okay, don't bring it in the door. You don't want me to know, don't bring it in the door.
Yeah. I also think like you got to be, you know, like if you're doing this on your own and to try to process something, that's mad risky. Like, So I definitely think like, you know, even for some of my clients who work with curanderos or curanderas, like these individuals are generationally practicing this. And, you know, that's their craft. And I got a lot of respect for that. So I think it depends on like who you're going to, like, is it paired with a person who is trained in the scope of what you're trying to address, and being mindful and intentional about that, because you have like, ayahuasca is probably, I mean, I would say that didn't necessarily start with the mental health field. That shit's been here. Sorry.
That's fine.
That's been existing for, you know, culturally for generations.
Yeah, so I mean, exactly.
You gotta pay dues where stuff's originated from. But I also think that, you know, treating chronic mental illness is real. And so just making sure that you're knowing the risks and benefits, because I've also worked with people who have tried psychedelics and struggle after, right, with paranoia or other side effects that I don't, you know, I'm not skilled, I don't know much about, but that is something to consider, right? There are real benefits to certain models, and there are also certain risks.
Excellent point.
And, sorry, I think the other thing, and I think you bring up a good point, Brittany, it's about the stigma too, right? Mm-hmm. Like mental health has so much stigma already that just even getting into therapy is already, you know, looked or frowned upon. And then you're going to add another stigmatized issue as psychedelics. Like, again, for me in my mind, and I supervise a lot of interns, and like Sabrina, what you were saying about systems, like, they might hate me, but I'm like, you need to know how your clients get into the system. You need to know how the system impacts them. Because as therapists in private pay or in private practice, if you don't know how the systems work, you can't function. Because like Brittany was saying, if you don't know about curanderos, or if you don't know about shamans, or if you don't know about this, and someone comes in and you're just like, I'm a private therapist, you're going to miss out on great opportunities to support your client, right? Or to say, you know what, that might not be the best approach for you. Like, I respect that you're going to a priest, but confession every Friday is not the same as therapy, you know, every week. It's completely different, right?
Right.
So like all of this, I'm like, you should have prepped me, Ernesto, because I'm like ready to go. I don't even do lobby days. I don't
Okay, there's a lot of energy behind it. See, that's why I'm so glad that we have this diverse group of people here, because obviously there's some thoughts that people have about stuff, and that's awesome for what we're doing here. And so but you brought up Mara, you know, the stigma and you also brought up marijuana, and you know, that's changing. That's a very dynamic topic. I'm wondering, Heather, where you are, is marijuana, I don't know, what's the status of marijuana where you are? Is it recreational, legal?
So, yeah. So, you know, I think about it from the involuntary client perspective, because the majority of my work has been with involuntary clients through the public care system. And where I am, marijuana is not legal. And, you know, we come into contact with a lot of families or parents that do utilize marijuana to address their underlying mental health needs. And I actually did a video recently on this and got some heat. And I'm like, hey, you know, it is what it is. If you have anxiety or depression, the proper thing is to go and get treatment. And I understand that's a privilege to be able to reach out for that treatment. But when you come into contact with child welfare services, you know, smoking marijuana or hearing about this new treatment for psychedelics, you know, we hear all kinds of excuses from these clients as to why they're using what illegal substance they're using. But if we're there and offering the resource of the referral to get the necessary treatment to treat their underlying need, you know, then that's the expectation. And most often they are court ordered to do so. Mm-hmm. So when I first watched this, I was like, oh Lord, this just, you know, anytime an involuntary client hears about something like this, it like spreads like wildfire, word of mouth. And then it becomes like the trend of like why they're telling their social worker, like, oh yeah, well I did LSD because I saw this video and they said it was going to help me, you know? Mm-hmm. So that's kind of the perspective I come from of like, oh no, like this just gives them more excuses to come up, mm-hmm. up with.
Yeah, and I'm,
instead of getting at the underlying need that they have.
Uh-huh. Yeah, and I'm glad you said that. That's interesting. That so you're in a state where marijuana is illegal, and here in California, it's legal. And so, you know, that from the DFS or from the child welfare perspective, that brings, you know, very interesting situations up. And it's been pretty dynamic in child welfare in California, trying to figure out how do you manage, you know, this substance that's legal. And for a time, it was like in limbo, like kind of legal but not legal. And so, you know, the same thing that you're saying, when clients come in with, you know, before they might have had a card for marijuana or whatever it is, how do you kind of navigate those waters? And as time has gone on, a lot of child welfare systems here have started to figure out what their policies will be with that. But, you know, as psilocybin and other things enter into the conversation, it's an ongoing thing. And you're right. As far as I'm concerned in child welfare, it's still, you know, it's another thing that clients have, sometimes to self-medicate, to deal with things that they, because they don't have access elsewhere to try to deal with stuff, but also, you know, can become problematic to what we're actually trying to do with their case. And so for Sabrina, I was wondering if you have any thoughts just, you know, with from the policy level, and some of these pharma companies, I don't know if you have any experience in this area, but just as they see these quote unquote, I don't know if you call them traditional or natural substances coming online that could potentially kind of move in on their whether it's Adderall or whatever it may be. Have you had any experience or have any thoughts about what that kind of higher level policy thing might become with these substances as they come potentially on board?
Yeah, they'll just lobby for only the man-made version of these natural substances that people, particularly Indigenous folks, have been using for millennia. They're just going to lobby so that you can't use the naturally occurring Indigenous version of these drugs. You will only be able to medicate utilizing the synthetic version of all of these is the direction that they would go in the minute that they can. I mean, and I always laugh because it's still one of those things where federally marijuana is still illegal federally. And so you're just like, well, that's been messy for a really long time since Colorado, you know, since town in Colorado. So but that's the next step in all of it.
Yeah, that totally totally tracks with what mm-hmm. Felix, what do you think? Any thoughts on this, on psilocybin mushrooms and how that impacts your work or what you do?
Well, when I was in CPS, we actually treated marijuana like alcohol because it's legal here in Colorado. So it was pretty much the same, or carried the same weight as if a parent was intoxicated from drinking. Mm-hmm. And our policies around it was, as long as you have a lockbox and it's out of the reach of the children, and there always had to be a sober caregiver.
Yeah, that's kind of California's approach too at this point for now. I actually do have a friend of mine who is very familiar with the kind of like the traditional indigenous utilization of substances. And he's kind of, the last time I talked to him, I think he's trying to figure out maybe if he wants to start looking more into bringing it into his work as a therapist. So maybe we'll have a chance to talk with him or someone else that can bring that perspective. So any last thoughts on this topic?
I don't, but and so I have to head out.
Well, that's perfect, because so do we.
Okay. We're about to call it.
Okay. So if you need to stop out or step out, go ahead and thanks for coming. But we're going to end right now anyway.
Okay.
So I want to thank, first of all of you for being here. I think we had some super interesting conversations, and what I had hoped for, and I think a few of us here were kind of hoping to hear all these different perspectives and viewpoints on topics. And I feel like we got that and had some fun doing it along the way. So I don't know if anyone has any last thoughts they want to give before we end this week's or this session or this edition.
Hopefully we didn't turn anyone away. This is social work is a great field. Like,
yeah.
We're just breaking it down for you.
Yeah. I mean, I think a lot of people want to know the real thing. Like, we all get the school, we all get the training, but there's also, I think, a time and place for the, you know, the real conversation from those doing the work in all different areas. So anyone else? All right. If not, then thank you everyone for watching, and you can look for everyone here on TikTok, I think primarily, but other platforms, we've heard Instagram and stuff. And maybe next time I'll have people's names up here, their usernames or whatever. But for now, you know who we are. And so you can search for us and join us next time. We'll have a different set of topics, maybe different people or the same people. Hopefully we're all bringing a lot to the table here. So thanks everyone. And we'll go ahead and end it, and we'll see you next time.
So that was the first episode of the world's best social work show. Hope you enjoyed it if you made it this far. And make sure that you like or follow or subscribe or whatever is appropriate here so that you can get notified when we come out with these regular episodes, where we will have rotating co-hosts, very different topics, and a casual, relaxed conversation with the lens of a social worker or a therapist or a helping professional. So like, follow, subscribe, whatever's appropriate, and I will talk to you next time. Thanks for listening.